Hi, I'm Elisa Lamel, Legal Content Specialist at Krauss Financial Services. Today I am joined by two very special guests, Certified Elder Law Attorney Tim Takis and Elder Care Coordinator Patty Bedwell, both at the Takis and McGinnis Elder Law Firm located in Hendersonville, Tennessee. Beyond being an incredible advocate for his senior clients, Tim has achieved many accomplishments over the years, including founding both the Special Needs Alliance and the Life Care Planning Law Firms Association. He was also recently honored with a SAGE Award in 2021 for his significant impact on the lives of seniors in Middle Tennessee. Joining him today is Patty Bedwell, who has more than 20 years of experience working with the elderly and their families as a former activities director at a nursing home. Additionally, for over 5 years, Patty was a district long-term care ombudsman in Middle Tennessee, where she handled complaints and coordinated training for more than 40 volunteers. Today, we are discussing a topic that means a lot to both of our guests, residents' rights in a nursing home. We'll cover what those rights are, how to protect them, and what to do if those rights are being infringed upon. Hi, Tim and Patty. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Glad to be with you.
Thank you.
Well, we really appreciate it. So today we're going to be talking about residents' rights in a nursing facility, what those rights are, how they work, and you guys are the pro on this. So we'll start right off the bat. When a resident enters a nursing home, what changes with their rights? Do they lose any rights at that point? What did they have the day before that they no longer have the day they enter?
Actually, really, when a resident goes into a nursing facility or any kind of licensed healthcare facility, they maintain the same rights that they had prior to coming in. The only thing that really changes is the setting in which they're living. So most people have gone from their home, and now they're living in a very communal setting, you know, kind of like going back to living in the dorm. So you have the same rights, but sometimes the way that those rights are implemented are impacted just by the environment. So you have to be more aware of other people's residents, you know, and that or rights, excuse me, things like that.
Okay. So things like, you know, not having visitors at midnight or playing your radio loud at 2 a.m. Just kind of common concerns then with other
people. Yeah, just common courtesies.
Right.
Really.
Like you were in a college dorm, they always would say after 11 o'clock or after midnight, you can't play your stereo full blast, that sort of thing. Yes. Those of us who remember that.
So Patty, you were a local ombudsman board or ombudsman member in your area. What were some of the common grievances or complaints that residents would bring up to you?
Well, the complaints really, there were really lots of different types of complaints. But some of the most prominent complaints had to do with food, food preferences, cold food, hot food, things like that, privacy issues. Some on visitation and access, you know, things of that nature.
Okay. And so what about if a resident does have questions about their rights, what they're entitled to, their treatment, where can they go to find those rights? Or is there someone they can talk to about that?
Yeah, each facility is going to have the resident rights posted. So those rights are going to be posted in a public area. Facilities also include copies of the resident rights in the admission packets and paperwork, although usually on the day of admissions, there's so much stuff going on that that's one of those pieces of paper that, you know, people rarely see or look at. But for questions about their right, I would start with the facility social worker. That's usually the go-to person for any questions, concerns, any information that you want to know about the facility. I would start with that social worker.
Right. And one of the things to remember, too, is that posting of the rights, residents' rights, that's federal law. Mm-hmm. The law requires that. So they have to be posted in a prominent place. So for instance, if you're looking at, attorneys or others are looking at the rules and regulations, they're basically looking at, you know, I don't want to quote too much, but it's like 42 Code of Federal, 42 CFR, Code of Federal Register, you know, section 483.10 is the residence rights. And 483.15 is admission, transfer, and discharge rights. Yeah, and that's kind of like the Bible that, you know, that the basically the ombudsman use, you know, in some ways. And we'll talk some more about some authorities after, you know, as we go along.
Right. And also the ombudsman information, that's something else that is federally mandated to be posted in a public area. And it's not, it's supposed to be their poster, you know, their information that they provide. So it can't be fancied up and prettied up and put into a nice little frame. It's supposed to stick out in the building, and that will have the contact information for the district ombudsman, who's the person that residents could call that would come to their facility and talk with them and help them through whatever issue or concern there might be. That's another place that you could call to find out more about resident rights.
Okay. And so some of the public places, would it be something like the common room or maybe the cafeteria where they eat breakfast and dinner? Where would some of those places be?
Yeah, it is going to be in a public place. When I was an ombudsman, I often asked facilities to move the poster. Can't be posted on the front door, you know, because not many residents are looking at the front door from the outside, you know. So some facilities, if they have elevators, they'll post them in their elevator or by the elevator, outside the cafeteria, close to the front desk, just a variety of places. The regulation just requires that they have to be posted publicly so residents have access to that information. That information is another thing that's included in the admission paperwork too. Though another one of those little pieces of paper that may get, you know, trapped at the bottom of the stack.
Yes, and like always, as like lawyers always say, is that when someone hands you a piece of paper, particularly about something like this, you should read it. You know, read your legal documents, and if you have questions, that's what we're here for. And it's the same thing that applies in the facility.
It is. And some facilities, and sadly, there's only been a very few of these that I've gone to, they'll have somebody that maybe, and usually the social worker or the activity director, that after the person is in the facility a week or two and things have settled down, they'll go in and visit with that resident and say, hey, did you see this? You know, let's go over and let me make sure that you know what your rights are.
Oh, perfect. Okay, so let's talk about when there's an activated power of attorney a little bit, because I know there can kind of be some confusion on what the rights are. So if a resident does have an activated healthcare power of attorney, are they still able to deny treatment, refuse treatment, change their treatment? Are they still able to partake in their care plan, or does the POA now have to make all those decisions for them?
The person always has the right to participate in their care plan and should participate in their care plan. Now, we all know as progression of illnesses goes, there may come a point where that person wants their power of attorney to take over and make decisions. The facility, though, should always include the resident in those decisions. Even if the resident has said, you know, I want my daughter to take care of everything, you know, if there's going to be a change in their status, their medication, whatever might be going on, they should still try to include that resident as much as possible. That sometimes is difficult for the power of attorney to deal with, because they feel like they have been given this authority and they want to be able to use that authority. And sometimes they want to use it to where maybe the resident, you still want that resident to be able to express their needs and their desires. So the facility has to work to bring those two things together.
So it sounds like the resident has the ultimate decision in their care, and the power of attorney can maybe weigh in on it, but the final decision rests with the resident.
Yeah, and that's ultimately patient, you know, what we lawyers think of as you know, patient autonomy. You know, the you know, I guess what patient autonomy is, I guess, you know, the person's, you know, the person's right of autonomy and to make decisions, decisions for himself or herself, you know, whether they're healthcare or whatever those decisions might be.
Okay, so another common concern that we hear from a lot of our clients is about payment. A lot of elderly clients are concerned when they enter the nursing home, they don't know how to pay for it. A lot of them end up maybe with you, Tim, and they do Medicaid crisis planning, spend down.
Right.
Can a resident ever be evicted or discharged from a facility when they're trying to apply for Medicaid and get help paying for it?
No.
No.
According to the federal guidelines, if a person has applied for Medicaid, the facility can only charge them the whatever that rate is. Usually their income, you know, is what they're going to be paying moving forward, but they cannot discharge a person due to a pending Medicaid application. But people need to be sure that when they admit to a facility and there's the possibility that they're going to utilize Medicaid, make sure it's a facility that actually accepts Medicaid, because there are some that don't. And then that facility would have every right to initiate discharge proceedings right. against that resident for failure to pay. The facility, though, is still obligated to find a safe and appropriate discharge location for that person. They can't, you know, like put them in a car and just send them home, knowing there's, you know, not a safety net there for them to be safe and secure once they get there.
Exactly, because presumably, in our world, we say, okay, well, you know, we see people who maybe are, they come to us when they're already in the facility and they're already residents there, or maybe they come to us when they're in the hospital, you know, and they're facing a discharge, and then we'll counsel them and say, you want to make sure that you talk to the social worker or the discharge planner and to be so that they know that you're looking for a facility that accepts Medicaid or participates in the Medicaid program, in the state Medicaid program. That's just sort of essential information. And certainly if you're a discharge planner in a hospital, you know, and, you know, we have, you know, one of our elder care coordinators here that was, you know, she was a discharge planner. Is that they want to know, you know, that's a question that the discharge planner should be, you know, they should be having conversations with the patient in the hospital about, okay, what are your preferences? Do you want something close here? Are you looking for, you know, are you looking for Medicaid as a payment source? Are you going to be private pay? I mean, that's just sort of their job. But of course, needless to say, you don't want to assume anybody is actually doing their job the right way, you know, but of course, that's our job as well. So once the person becomes a resident of the facility, I mean, say a patient in the skilled nursing facility, you know, most of them, certainly in our state, they go from the hospital to the skilled nursing facility. That's how they get into a nursing home, a long-term care nursing home residence, nursing facility. You know, is that's the progress. You can't discharge, you know, under the regulations, a resident cannot be discharged when they're seeking Medicaid. You know, and I've heard, you know, when I was a little baby elder law attorney, I heard people talk about, some facilities sort of subtly require people to be private pay, you know, for a certain period of time, and that they sort of promise that we won't apply for Medicaid until, until maybe 6 months or whatever that number is. Now, maybe they still do that in certain states, but they don't do it here in Tennessee.
And they shouldn't be doing that really in any state, because the regulations do clearly state that, you know, a facility cannot require payment from a resident who is eligible, full payment for a resident who is eligible for the Medicaid program and is actively trying to apply.
Yeah.
So again, it really is important to know where you're going and what services are available.
So to find out if a facility is Medicaid approved, is that something they ask when they enter? Can they look that up? How would you know that?
Well, you can easily look it up. That's pretty easy information to find. But the discharge planner is going to know that information as well. So if you're working with the hospital discharge planner, that's really where it all starts. And you just need to let them know what type of facility you need.
Yeah.
Now, if it's just going to be a short-term rehab, maybe it doesn't matter that much. But a lot of us go into, or a lot of people go into the situation thinking, oh, this is going to be just a short-term thing. And then they're there and something else happens and now they're long-term and they have no way to pay for their care.
Yeah. You know, and what's interesting, I think, you know, having done this for a while is that, you know, our clients and our families, they say they go into the hospital, you know, and they're thinking that, you know, the hospital is there to go, okay, so how are we going to treat this patient? You know, and what, you know, and obviously that's part of what, that's why their patient is there in the hospital. But there's another part of that hospital that is specifically tasked with, how are we going to get rid of this patient? You know, there is a, you know, there's an in and, you know, an in and out thing. So, okay, great. You know, you're there for hopefully therapy, efficacious treatment or whatever. But then there's the other side of the hospital that says, well, we can't keep this person. You know, we have to get rid of this patient as soon as we can. And a lot of our families, we kind of, that's part of the education here, you know, is to educate our clients and our families that once you're done in the hospital, you're done and they want you out.
Discharge starts the yeah. moment that you're admitted to a facility.
Exactly.
Somebody is working on
and getting you out of there.
Okay, so it sounds like if you are then at a nursing home and they're trying to discharge you from a nursing home, they're not sending you back to the hospital. They want you to go someplace else.
Yes. Now, I'd like to say that facilities never send people to the hospital and refuse to take them back, but that does happen. It is not the way that the regulations say it should happen, but that, you know, sadly, that does happen sometimes. So it really takes somebody being very vocal about that to try to get that to not work out that way.
Okay. So what about a resident who is in an assisted living facility? Are their rights any different than they would be in a skilled nursing facility, or are they the same?
No, the rights are the same. But what people get most confused about when they're talking about assisted living and nursing home is they think they have the same, maybe close to the same care, and they follow the same regulations, and they do not.
Yeah, assisted livings don't. Yeah.
Yeah, they are not regulated by CMS. There are no federal guidelines for assisted living. Each state has their own set of regulations for their assisted living facilities. But as far as the rights, the rights always remain the same. And most assisted living facilities will post the rights just like they do, you know, in the nursing homes. The ombudsman information and all that stuff should all be in that building as well.
Right. And because an assisted living facility is a licensed healthcare facility, I mean, that's ultimately where, you know, that and and it's state licensed. And of course, nursing homes are also state licensed as well. So, but because the payment source for nursing facilities is typically Medicaid, you know, even if it's just a solely private pay facility,
they still take Medicare dollars.
Yeah, they still take Medicare dollars. And so they're governed by federal law, primarily. A lot of those rights or obligations that are imposed on nursing facilities are imposed, you know, because regardless of payment.
Okay, interesting. So assisted living facilities are more guided by state regulations, nursing homes by federal regulations.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and all of us know that there are facilities, at least I think all of us know, but, you know, there are some assisted living facilities that accept Medicaid. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are in our state, there are, I'm sure, probably in other states, and that's sort of like the home and community-based services Medicaid, you know, that we, you know, that a lot of our, some of our clients are in, you know, but nonetheless, you know, the, you know, I guess the transfer and discharge rights don't apply there as well, or do they?
Well, they, again, the assisted living is governed by their set of regulations, yeah. But when I was an ombudsman, I did take a stand, you know, for some residents that they needed to follow those same discharge regulations because they are following the CMS guidelines.
Right. Yeah.
It didn't always fly very, very high, though.
Yeah.
So regardless of where you're residing, residents still have their federal rights. So what happens if they feel mistreated? What are their options? Do they start with bringing it up to a staff member? How do they remedy that?
Well, that really depends on how they feel about the facility and what kind of relationships they've established. If they're comfortable talking with someone in the facility, the person that fields most of the complaints or is the starting point for most of the complaints would be the social worker. So that's where I'd go. Sometimes residents will talk to the activity director because they've become close to the activity staff, just, you know, by virtue of the activities being more fun than, you know, working with nursing and that sort of thing. So if the resident has someone that they can comfortably talk to, I would suggest that they voice those complaints at the facility, because a facility can never remedy a problem they don't know about. But there are situations where residents just don't feel comfortable doing that. There's a variety of reasons for that. Interestingly enough, the most common reason I was told when I was an ombudsman was they didn't want to get anybody in trouble. You know, they didn't like that their whatever was going on, but they still didn't want their techs to get in trouble for them complaining. They also fear retaliation. So those are two big things that often hinder people from making a complaint directly to anyone at the facility. So options outside the facility would be, the best option would be your district ombuds, district or state ombuds. Again, that information is available in the facility. You can ask where that information is, but my experience had told me, shown me that a lot of the residents who fear retaliation, they're just going to sneak around that facility until they find that poster themselves. And then they'll call the number and follow through. Mm-hmm. And then hopefully the ombudsman, you know, is able to intervene and to help, you know, field those complaints and get some resolution. So the other option would be they can file a complaint with the state. That information will also be found in the, it'll be posted in the facility. And they can call and make a formal complaint to the state. That would be the group that holds licensure over the facility. And they're obligated to go in and investigate any complaints that they receive. Mm-hmm. The difference with calling the ombudsman and the calling the state complaint hotline would be the ombudsman usually can get in there much quicker than what someone, one of the surveyors could. Because complaints that go to the state, unless they're really dire, those complaints are usually investigated when the surveyors go in to do their regularly scheduled survey. And so that may be in the next month, it may be in the next 18 months. So sometimes that's a longer process than what some people want to wait for resolution.
So Patty, does the family councils have any, how do they fit into this
Well, family councils are not something that nursing homes have to have, but those are great things for them to offer to the families. But nursing homes will also, they'll have resident councils. And that's a group of residents that get together on a regular basis. And that's what they do. They talk about the facility in general, you know, and if they have determined, this group of residents have determined, you know, that maybe there's not enough linens on the weekends, or maybe this staff member is not doing what needs to be done, or they need this service improved. That's a place that residents as a group can voice those concerns. And those concerns are taken directly to the administration of the facility. And that facility or administration is obligated to get back to that resident council, letting them know what steps they're going to take, or letting them know why it is that they cannot do anything about that complaint.
And I think that's actually a resident right too.
It is.
You know, to have a residence council.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But again, that's in the nursing home. That's not mandated to have that in an assisted living facility. Some still do, but it's not something that they're mandated to do.
Okay, so it sounds like a couple different options if you're looking for some help with a complaint then. A couple different options. Perfect. Okay, well, thank you very much both for your time. It's very much appreciated. So if we have any viewers who have questions about residents' rights, they want to reach out to you for some help and talk to you, how can they connect with you?
Well, you can go on our website at tn-elderlaw.com. So we have a contact us page, or you can send an email to info@tn-elderlaw.com. You know, and that's sort of like our general mailbox here, and somebody's monitoring that regularly. So if somebody has a question that they want to pass on to either Patty or me or one of the other ECCs or, you know, someone here at the office, just as a aside, you know, we have a dedicated public benefit specialist who basically does Medicaid, or as it's called in Tennessee, MedTenCare. We have a dedicated public specialist who works with Medicare. You know, since all of our clients are on Medicare, so like and frankly, here we are. We're taping this in mid-October, so right now he's very busy with open enrollment. Mm-hmm. You know, but he's generally, you know, but we're all available here if people have questions. You know, and we like questions. We like people to contact us. You know, and frankly, you know, if maybe it's another attorney that has a question, you know, or maybe, you know, whoever's watching this, what we're likely to do is if they send an email to us, we're going to refer them to somebody who is, you know, maybe a NALA member or an elder council member or somebody that, or Life Care Planning Law Firms Association member, you know, in their state. There are a lot of things that we can't practice in other states, you know, but we know just about everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, having done this for a long period of time.
Mm-hmm. So we do like to make sure that anybody who calls our office with a question is going to get an answer, either an answer from us or a resource to get that question answered.
Yeah.
And if I could go back to just one thing I wanted to add. You had asked initially about what kind of complaints I heard the most. I just wanted to say one of the most misunderstood rights that all of us have, including all the residents, is the right to refuse. And that's just one of the things that, I just wanted to throw that in there, because residents still have the right to say, no, I don't want to do that. No, I'm not going to, whatever that might be. And it's not a behavioral issue. It's just their right to express themselves and their want.
Absolutely. And as we discussed, again, it's part of taking a part in their care plan and their treatment. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. And another thing to think, you know, about is, you know, we've given some citations to the federal regulation, but the But CMS, the U.S. Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, they also publish interpretive guidance of the regulations. You know, and those are available to anybody, I guess, that either wants to purchase them or maybe they're online or something. Mm-hmm. So literally, you know, some, like, for instance, some of the, you know, the transfer and discharge rights that facilities have, you know, those have been interpreted by CMS. So they will give guidelines. And, you know, as lawyers, we would say that they do not have the force of law, but they are persuasive authority. You know, so a facility is, you know, doing something which is maybe arguably, maybe questionable, you know, that would be something that we would recommend, you know, that a person go to those interpretive guidelines to see, you know, how has CMS sort of,
yeah, this is the regulation and this is how we're seeing it.
Yeah, this is how we're interpreting this, is, you know, these are the circumstances that were, you know, where we think that, you know, that the resident is correct or that the facility is correct, you know, mm-hmm. So
there's lots of tools available.
Right.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's very good to know. Well, thank you both so much for your time. You are both just a wealth of knowledge. So I really appreciate you taking your time to be with us today.
You're welcome. Thank you, Elisa.
Thank you.